Russia. Oh. Oh. Base.
10 females to each male.
A Coca-Cola machine.
Fluids.
The doomsday machine.
Blast off!
My shorts.
Where's the bathroom?
Buck, should I get it?
On the hotline.
Dr. Strangelove.
Or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and
Love the Bomb.
A moving picture.
I shouldn't tell you this, Mandrake, but you're a good officer and you have a right to know. It looks like we're in a shooting war.
Hell. All the Russians involved, sir.
Well, boys, I reckon this is it. Nuclear combat toe-to-toe with the Ruskies.
I was under the impression that I was the only one in authority to order the use of nuclear weapons.
That's right, sir. You are the only person authorized to do so. And although I hate to judge before all the facts are in, it's beginning to look like General Ripper exceeded his authority.
I first became aware of it, Mandrake, during the physical act of love.
Missile still deflecting. Range 1 mile. Start lever to cut off. Cut off. Change in power. Little power. Break it.
Has that plane really got a chance of getting through?
Well, sir, if the pilot's good, see? I mean, if he's really sharp, he can barrel that baby in solo. I mean, you ought to see it sometime. It's a sight. A big plane, like a 52 room. It's jet exhaust, frying chickens in the barnyard.
Dr. Strangelove.
Or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and
Love the Bomb.
Welcome to episode 28 of Film Gold. This is my first offering of 2024 for this podcast. As I've said many times, it does get somewhat neglected alongside my other two podcasts, which are Glass Onion on John Lennon and Life and Life Only. But here we go. Here's an episode for you. I hope you enjoyed that marvellously ambiguous trailer, especially with just audio. But I'm going to presume that you've probably seen this film before listening to this review. Or you could at least watch the trailer with the images, which is in the show notes. This is just a quick introduction. So this is Dr. Strangelove, currently placing at number 27 out of 1,541 films on my Flick chart, on flickchart.com. Sandwiched between Trainspotting, just above it, which is a bit of a heart over head choice. I think it's a great film, but it's so much a part of the 90s when I first saw it, when I was in my early 20s, and then Annie Hall just below it. I think objectively, Dr. Strangelove could lay claim to being among the very best of the films I've seen, but of course that's not really how film rankings work when you're making personal choices. There's not too much to say here, as this conversation does cover a lot of ground, but just to say that, as you will hear, this is a swapcast with The Mind Renewed. And Julian Charles, the host of that show, basically hosts this discussion, although we do share the legwork to some extent. Julian has been featured on Life and Life Only a few times and was on Film Gold previously to review Groundhog Day, which was episode 6. He and I have done many podcasts together, and there is a passing mention later in the conversation to the fact that Julian first featured an audio essay of mine on his podcast almost 10 years ago. the 12th of April, 2014, to be precise. And that was the first time I was actually on a podcast. So I suppose you've got him to thank slash blame for my podcast activity since. He helped me get the bug. And then, of course, it was 2019 when I actually started my first podcast, which is Glass Onion. But we do have a good rapport and a nice rhythm to our conversations, honed over 10 years of having them. More sporadically than it used to be, but we will be doing another collaboration, at least one more this year. Probably more, I think, because I am now in on the film roundtable series that he does with Mark and Frank. I featured, I think, Capricorn 1. That was one of our movie roundtables that Julian hosted. Anyway, hopefully that some of that rapport and that rhythm will be evident here. So now I leave you in the capable hands of Julian Charles of The Mind Renewed. And I'll see you when I see you for more Film Gold. Enjoy.
Hello, everybody. Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you, as usual, from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And welcome to TMR number 308 for the 15th of our cultural roundtables, although it's not actually going to be a roundtable this time, it's going to be a dialogue. And it's also not just TMR, it's also Film Gold, because we're going to be having our dialogue with our good friend Anthony Rotuno of the Film Gold podcast. So it's a swap cast, and we're going to be talking, as we normally do, about a film or other kind of production that has some relevance to themes that have been explored on TMR over the last decade or so. So Anthony, good to have you on the show again. How are you doing?
I'm fine, yeah. It's good to be back home, Julian, because we haven't done one of these two-handers for a while, yeah. By the way, a swapcast doesn't mean that Julian does all the work and I nab the audio. It does mean that the work does get shared out, everybody.
Absolutely. That's very true.
Very, very nice to be here, yeah.
All right, it's great to be speaking to you again. It feels like a long time, actually, to, as I say, to have one of these dialogues. It's great. Okay, so we're going to be talking about that extremely famous film, but wonderful film, called Dr. Strangelove. And I love the subtitle, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, from 1964. Of course, by Stanley Kubrick, a political satire, black comedy, perhaps the blackest comedy of all time in some ways. I think Kubrick called it a nightmare comedy. So we're going to be talking about a nightmare comedy here. And you suggested this as a film that you particularly wanted to do. Yes. And I was really happy to do it. It's on my list of things to do. So that's great. Well, why? I'd like to ask you first, why did you particularly want to do this one? Why is it near the top of your list?
Oh, many reasons. It has always been a big favourite of mine, even from when I was not necessarily a child, but a teenager. I don't think I quite got it. I mean, obviously, I didn't know as much about the world as I hopefully do now. I think it just works so perfectly on a couple of levels. You can just get off on the comedy of it, you know, if you don't want to take it too seriously and think about its role in life. I mean, various reasons, really. Stanley Kubrick is my favourite director.
Right.
It used to be Hitchcock, and I still love Hitchcock and various other people, Scorsese, Coppola, but Stanley's the man, really. And I think the age of film analysis, and I will mention my friend Rob Agar again. He always gets mentioned on these, doesn't he? Stanley has benefited greatly, I think, or Stanley's legacy from Rob and various other people, because there's just so much there. Another reason was because we did do 13 Days quite recently.
Oh, yeah.
It's obviously around the same period. JFK is not obviously in this story, but it just works nicely as a contrast. And I don't know if you find this, when we're planning these film roundtables, the great films just almost get greater in the planning.
Yeah.
And also during the conversations, or I actually am fairly confident that when we come out of this today, I'll probably love it even more than I do now. But yeah, those are the main reasons of many, but almost like to say that who needs a reason, really, but we've got a few there.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. We don't. You brought up Hitchcock there, and I was just thinking to myself, well, Stanley Kubrick, of course, is a perfectionist, as was well known. And I think actually with Hitchcock, was he such a perfectionist? He did so much stuff. Maybe that was, you know, hit and miss at times. I don't know.
I think what Hitchcock did was he planned very well. And I mean, obviously Kubrick planned very well, but Hitchcock planned it very carefully, and his wife used to help him as well with the stories. And then once the filming started, he was almost a bit bored by the filming. And you get this a little bit. I think even Woody Allen said the same thing years ago. The fun bit is having the ideas.
Right.
And then you think, oh, I've got to get a load of actors and a crew and everything and actually make this thing happen.
Yeah.
But I think Hitchcock famously was misquoted as saying that actors are like cattle. And when he was picked up on that, he said, no, I didn't say actors are like cattle. I said they should be treated like cattle. So I don't think he was. I think he was a bit more obsessive in the story and everything. I think once he was on set, maybe he did let it go a little bit.
And famously appeared in his own films, didn't he?
Yeah.
I love that.
Just very quick word. I think I told you once that Dan Richter, who played Moonwatcher in 2001, he has been on my John Lennon podcast, plug, Glass Onion on John Lennon, because he also was John and Yoko's friend and personal assistant. And of the various things he said about Stanley, even though we talk about John Lennon, I got him to talk about Stanley. He said Stanley was a nice guy. And part of the perfectionism was you do a good take.
Yeah.
And where a lot of directors would say, oh, that was good, fine, put that in the can. Kubrick would say, that was really good, Dan, but should we just try one more? Because maybe it could be better. I don't think he drove Dan Richter mad, but I think he might have driven other people mad. It just depends, doesn't it? You know, if you're working with an actor who doesn't want to do that, then that might rub you up the wrong way. But the results speak for themselves.
Yeah, was it George C. Scott in this film? I understand that Kubrick got him to do lots of takes pretending they were practice takes and then sort of kidded him and used those practice takes as the real thing. But
that's right. Yeah. The cartoony ones.
Yeah.
Which I just think is perfect. I mean, he also one-upped, I'm sure you know this, he would one-up actors by taking them on at chess.
Yeah.
George C. Scott was actually a fairly decent chess player, but Kubrick sort of got it was the way, his way of getting the upper hand. Yeah.
Nice. Okay. Well, there's no nude swimming in this, so Frank and Mark don't need to feel disappointed in not being in this conversation. So I'm wondering, Anthony, if you could perhaps give us a bit of a plot summary. I mean, people will know this film. Vast majority, 99.9% of people will know this film really well, but it's good to have a bit of a reminder. Could you just give us a short rundown of it?
Yeah. The plot itself, it's basically about General Jack D. Ripper. Fantastic name. Don't even need to say that. Of Burpleson Air Force Base. And I'm sure we'll talk more about names later on.
Yeah.
He believes that the American water supply is being fluoridated and it's a Soviet plot to poison Americans. And there's a mechanism whereby you could do a nuclear attack on the Soviet Union without the knowledge of the superiors, known as Plan R, which apparently probably did exist. And I'm going to say allegedly a few times when I talk about stuff I've discovered about this, but apparently it was a real thing. And apparently JFK at the time, president, just before this came out, obviously, didn't know about that. So that was kind of a real thing. Buck Turgidson, played by George C. Scott, is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And only Ripper knows the code, apparently, to recall the B-52s, and he shut down communication. So I suppose the idea is that almost that he wants it to happen in a funny way, you know, that he's blocking attempts not for this to happen. Anyway, so you've got also Group Captain Mandrake, which is one of Peter Sellers' roles. He's being held at the airbase by Ripper. He believes he knows the recall codes if he could get a message to the outside world. Meanwhile, in the war room, where you can't fight, as we know,
Right.
You've got President Merkin Muffley, Turgidson, and Dr. Strangelove, who suddenly appears. And I love that moment where suddenly Merkin Muffley, played by Peter Sellers, says, Dr. Strangelove, and everyone turns and goes, who's Dr. Strangelove? And that's Peter Sellers as well.
Yes, it's lovely.
So they're discussing measures to try and stop the attack and try and stop an all-out nuclear war. The Soviet ambassador is brought into the war room, and there's some fantastic bit of wrestling with him and Turgidson, and the scenes of the president and Dmitry, the Soviet premier, are just amazing. I'm sure we'll talk about that later, right?
So this is Dmitry on the end of the phone, isn't it, where he's talking to his...
Dmitry Kissoff.
Yeah, that's it. Just... Kissoff, yes, a lovely name.
I think all the names are already here. We probably don't even mention it. Then it's discovered that the Soviets have this, what's called the doomsday device. So if any of their key targets are hit, this device will go off and then you'll have the end of the world, or as good as. Meanwhile, you've got Major Kong, who's one of the main characters, is the bomber pilot. Now, it ends with him absolutely riding the bomb. So can you just help me with this bit, Julian, the very end?
Yeah.
What happens with Major Kong at the end there?
Well, they managed to...
How does he end up?
Yeah, it's because Mandrake does in fact work out what the three-digit code is from the doodlings that Jack Ripper has made. Because, of course, Jack Ripper, he heals himself, doesn't he? Takes the code with him to the grave. But he works it out from... He's constantly jotting down peace on Earth, and so it turns out to be P-O-E. Anyway, so they manage to use this code then to recall the bombers. But the one where Major Kong is in charge, that particular bomber has got so much damage that they don't get the recall notice. So they carry on dutifully to target. Well, they find a different target, but it's inside the Soviet Union, and I think it's an ICBM base. They fly low, and because they're so damaged, they can't get this bomb to release. So Major Kong goes down there and sits on the bomb and opens up the doors and sort of rodeos it down to target.
I mean, incredible, isn't it? Is there any more of the plot that you'd like to fill in there, just the plot itself?
Oh, I don't know. I think that's enough to remind people, I reckon.
I think they're the main points, weren't they?
Yeah, because I think as we go through, we'll hit on so much of it. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so where do we go from here? Let's just go through some of the bits and pieces then. Okay, so Dr. Strangelove, or as I say, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb as the subtitle, which is rather odd. Not a lot of films have subtitles, do they? But they did have other possibilities, which I thought were rather good. Dr. Doomsday or How to Start World War III Without Even Trying. I quite like that, actually.
Oh, it's a brilliant one. I love that. Yeah.
And this one, I don't know whether I can say this one on air, but I guess I will. I'll have to say it carefully. Or Doctor Strange... I can't say this one. Doctor Strange Love Secret Uses of Your...
Yes.
And...
Uranus, I think you meant, didn't you?
Yeah, sorry, Uranus. I'll say that again. Doctor Strange Love Secret Uses of Uranus. Yes. That's it. Wonderful Bomb. Wonderful Bomb. It's a Wonderful Life, I guess.
It's a Wonderful Bomb, yeah. Oh, that's it. It's a Wonderful Bomb. That would have been better, yeah.
Yeah,
I like that.
So it's directed and produced, of course, by Stanley Kubrick, and the screenplay, partly by Kubrick, but also by a satirist called Terry Southern and a guy called Peter George, who was, in fact, the author of the novel upon which it's based, called Red Alert. Yeah. Although he originally published it under a pseudonym, nom de plume, Peter Bryant, with a different title. I can't remember what the title was, but and of course it stars famously Peter Sellers, as you said, doing three parts, although we'll talk about it, but I think he originally was supposed to be doing four parts.
Right.
George C. Scott, Sterling Hayden, Slim Pickens, and some others, Tracy Reed, Keenan Wynn. Music by Laurie Johnson, we'll talk about in a bit, and filmed in black and white, which I think... Yep. Really was absolutely essential. I can't imagine it being in colour. Has it even crossed your mind what it would be like in colour?
Yeah, you get this a lot with films, don't you? I think sometimes we get so used to something being black and white. Let me take Psycho, for example, because they did do a colour remake.
Oh, right.
Did it make that much difference? I'm not sure.
I can't imagine it. I just think it gives it such a timeless kind of, almost like a documentary, almost a newsreel sort of quality that I think it would have been damaged by being in colour.
Maybe, yeah. I suppose it pegs it to the time, doesn't it? But that's yeah, that's a good thing. It's not a bad thing at all.
All right, let's talk about Peter Sellers then. I love Peter Sellers. I love the Goons.
yeah.
Of course, he was Group Captain Lionel Mandrake, this RAF exchange officer. He was also the US President Merkin Muffley and Dr. Strangelove, the war expert, the ex-Nazi war expert. I mean, he was perfect, wasn't he, to do these parts. So, I mean, as Lionel Mandrake, it was a stiff upper lip, Terry Thomas type of character.
Yeah, there was a bit of Terry Thomas.
Yeah, I think he knew Terry Thomas. I think they were friends. So maybe there was a bit of that.
Well, I think the story was he was in the RAF, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Not surprisingly, he used to mimic his superior. So it was essentially, it could have almost been a bit of revenge for him in a way, you know? So that was the easy one, I think.
Yes, probably was, yeah.
Muffley was based... apparently on Adlai Stevenson, who we mentioned when we did 13 Days, didn't we? The UN ambassador.
Who, as we said in the last show, you know, the show about JFK, he was heavily criticised, wasn't he? Particularly by the Republicans as being ineffectual and all that sort of thing. So I think Peter Sellers played it very much that way. He was very tedious, wasn't he? Very boring.
Yeah, played it straight. That's why all the stuff with Dimitri is so brilliant, because one thing I've learned about comedy is that when you've got someone playing it straight and saying ridiculous things or in a ridiculous context, it works so well. You can't have everyone playing it as a comedy. It weirdly doesn't work, does it?
No, absolutely. And in fact, I've got a quote here. Oh, if I can find it. This is the trouble, isn't it? Yeah, from the great Roger Ebert. Dr. Strangelove humor is generated by a basic comedy principle. People trying to be funny are never as funny as people trying to be serious and failing.
Yeah.
And he says, a man wearing a funny hat is not funny. But a man who doesn't know he's wearing a funny hat, now you've got something.
Absolutely.
So, and this is, the characters in Dr. Strangelove do not know their hats are funny.
That's it. Well, Monty Python, they used to do that, wouldn't they? They'd have an authority figure and the camera would pan round and, you know, he hasn't got any trousers on or something like that. But it's that juxtaposition of someone, as you said, being perfectly serious.
Yeah, yeah.
One thing about this character, Muffley, Sellers originally played him as an asthmatic. So presumably in between, you know, having this conversation with the Russian premier, he was taking blasts on his inhaler. I think it would have worked. I mean... you know, if they'd done that, we might have been here, you know, 60 years later saying what a great idea that was. You know, I don't think it was a bad idea at all.
Well, I heard that it was like he had a permanent cold sort of thing, and then people were laughing too much, so he couldn't carry on doing that. That's what I'd read.
Well, that was...
We did try it, but...
Yeah, that was a problem for the whole thing. I mean, you can see, I'm sure you know this as well, you can see the Russian ambassador, Peter Bull, laughing when he's doing the Strangelove stuff.
I did.
If anyone didn't notice that, folks, go back and watch it. When Dr. Strangelove's doing his stuff, Peter Bull's laughing. Couldn't stop it.
He was brilliant, actually. I love the way he was really, really serious and giving Merkin, Muffley, strange looks when he's on the telephone to Dmitri Kissoff.
Yeah.
Just looking at him like, I can't believe this idiot is saying what he's saying. Lovely. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
Can we just say that the Merkin Muffley, of course, the name, it's all about names here, isn't it? Every name is sort of played upon. A Merkin, I believe, is an erotic pubic wig.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, that adds to the sexual subtext.
It does. And a muffler is obviously used to reduce noise from an exhaust pipe. And I immediately thought, well, is this kind of trying to muffle the hot air that comes out of his mouth?
Well,
you know, as a politician.
As a language teacher, I tell my students that words have a certain energy. And even if they're not direct references. So something about, yeah, a muffler, it's almost like he's being... deflected from the truth, or it could, you know, something like that. There's definitely something in that name.
There is.
But it's not as clear, maybe, as Jack D. Ripper or, you know, one of those other names.
No, that's right. Yeah. Well, mandrake root, apparently, was used herbally to treat mania and convulsions.
Ah, very good.
And I just wondered, because, of course, Ripper is manic, isn't he? So is that... Is he sort of trying to control Ripper? Because he is, isn't he, in the story? He's trying to control this madman and get the three-digit code from him. So maybe there's something in that.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking of Mandrax, which was a popular drug in the 60s, but it wouldn't really fit with the character. So I think you're probably right there. Muffley, of course, does deliver the most famous line in the film. Do you mind if I do this?
No, go ahead.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is a war room.
Yeah, beautiful.
And of course, you know, let me finish, Dmitri. Can you turn the music down for Dmitri as well? Do you remember that?
There are lots of lovely lines, well-crafted lines in this. It's fantastic.
Yeah. As you know, last night I actually did a review of Dog Day Afternoon with Al Pacino. Fantastic film.
I am so jealous of that. So jealous.
You were jealous.
I was.
I'm sorry.
One of my favourite films. Love it.
One thing in that just tricked my memory with Strangelove is one of the hostages, she gets a phone call from her husband asking her what time she's going to be home. So she says to Al Pacino, any idea what time this is going to be finished? And he's like, well, I don't know. And she actually says to her husband, you hear her say to her husband on the phone, yeah, I'll just cook whatever's in the fridge. And I just thought it's another use of how everyday things are getting in the way of this sort of extreme situation.
Yeah, for anybody who's not seen that film, it's about three chaps who try to do a bank robbery and they're just too polite and they're completely inept and they don't know how to deal with these hostages. And so
they become friends with them, essentially. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. And it's based on reality. It's a fantastic film. Yeah.
Yeah, it's always hard to know where ideas start. I'm sure Dr. Strangelove didn't invent the idea that everyday stuff can get in the way of extreme situations, but it's just a good example. Yeah, we could talk about Buck Turgis in a minute if you want, but
we will do. Yeah. We'll talk about
he's got this girlfriend, and while he's in the war room and they're discussing, you know, the possible end of the world, he's saying, oh, I'll be back later, baby, don't worry, you know. No, I'm not only interested in you physically, it's all that. Oh, brilliant stuff.
So we've got the character of Dr. Strangelove himself, who's this nuclear war expert. He's an ex-Nazi, kind of stereotypical genius scientist plus a Nazi. But there's some sort of debate, isn't there, as to who he's based on. Obviously, we've got characters like Werner von Braun, who was brought over under Operation Paperclip, the end of the war, along with 1,600 plus other scientists and engineers to work on US ballistic program. But we've also got Helmut Kahn. We've also got Edward Teller, Henry Kissinger, all kinds of people are suggested. I have to say, from what I've read about it, it seems to me that it's centered in the character of Werner von Braun and maybe a bit of Helmut Kahn, who was an American physicist, military strategist, who Kubrick consulted with several times for the film. They got along really well, apparently. Kahn had a great sense of humour. And Kahn wrote a famous book called On Thermonuclear War just a few years before this film. And in that, he explored the idea of a doomsday machine. Not advising anybody to make such a thing or thinking that anybody would make such a thing, but just exploring the idea as the kind of logical conclusion to the doctrine of mutually assured destruction. So there's maybe, I think there is maybe a bit of Kahn in the character of Dr. Strangelove, but I do think it's mainly Werner von Braun.
Yeah, I guess it depends whether we're talking about personality or certain traits, because actually from doing research, I mean, there's little bits of lots of people. I mean, the voice, you know, it is a bit Kissinger, but I don't think Kissinger was very famous at that time.
No.
It was influenced by Austrian-American photographer Ouija, who worked for Kubrick as a special photographic effects consultant. And I think on YouTube, I believe you can listen to Ouija's voice, and it's very similar.
Right.
The gloves came from Kubrick. Kubrick used to wear these black gloves to avoid, what was it? Avoid his hands getting burned, wasn't it?
Something like that.
When handling hot lights.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit of Metropolis in there as well, as a character in Metropolis.
Oh, yeah.
Herman Kahn was with the Rand Corporation, I think.
He was.
And there's a reference in the film to the Bland Corporation later on. I'm just thinking, I'm sure most of your audience, Julian, would have heard of Operation Paperclip. I'll just say to the Film Gold audience, who are maybe not in on the alt media stuff, it's worth just researching that. Yeah, it was the US recruited top sort of technical talent, let's say, from the Nazis at the end of World War II. Yeah. And Werner von Braun, yeah. I mean, again, I didn't really know much about this until the last few years, let's say. He was the chief architect of the Saturn V or Saturn V launch vehicle that propelled the Apollo spacecraft to the moon. I mean, do you think most of the public know that? I don't know.
Probably not. Certainly not realise that he was also the designer of the V2 rocket under the Nazis.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. You
know, the same guy. Yeah. And then he worked with Disney.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Amazing.
Yes. Which is about as fluffy as you can get.
Yeah. But I mean, it hardly needs to be said, really, that Dr. Strangelove was not in the novel.
No.
And Kubrick acknowledged that Sellers did a lot of improvising. I imagine he improvised lines as well as the whole manner.
Yes.
Yeah, the whole sort of thing with the glove strangling himself and the Mein Führer.
Yes.
I mean, that's nothing to do with the novel. So I said Kubrick was laughing as well as Peter Ball. Kubrick was laughing as well. You know, the guy did have a sense of humour. He's been tagged as this kind of almost like a nihilistic character making these bleak films. But I don't think that's right at all, you know. I mean, this is not a bleak film. Definitely not.
So. Yeah, you're right. I was going to say that, yeah, you're right about Sellers improvising stuff. He did improvise that Zeke Heiling hand, didn't he? This alien hand syndrome, which apparently is a real thing, is now sometimes unofficially called Dr. Strangelove syndrome, where your hand, you know, is uncontrollable and does strange things. But I love the fact that this hand is still a Nazi.
Yeah.
And the rest of him is trying not to be a Nazi. It's this lovely idea.
Well, I always kid my mum when she's drinking tea and her little finger goes up and I say, oh, are you with the royal family? Because apparently that's the thing, isn't it, of upper class people. When they drink tea, their little finger goes up.
Yes.
I didn't mean to mention Dog Day Afternoon again, but funnily enough, Dog Day Afternoon, they improvised and it was actually incorporated into the script, which I believe happened here. And there is a name for it, retroscripting.
Yes.
Where the improvisations actually do become, they're typed up and they become the script. But yeah, what a genius, Peter Sellers. But if you know anything about his personal life, Arena did a very good documentary He had a very troubled relationship with his children. He's almost like the archetype genius who has trouble negotiating almost like normal life. Like he was more comfortable, apparently, in disguise, even if it was just silly voices or whatever.
Mm.
And Ringo Starr was in The Magic Christian.
Oh, yes.
Which I think Terry Southern wrote, I believe.
I think so.
And Ringo Starr...
I've seen a scene from that. That's all I've done, just a scene where I think the Peter Sellers character buys a picture, a very famous picture, and then just cuts the nose out in the shop.
I've seen it once. Yeah, it's a sort of critique of capitalism. But
right.
Now, the interesting... Ringo Starr said something really interesting. He said you'd get to know Peter... and you could go out for a drink with him. But then the next morning, it would be almost like you had to keep rebuilding the relationship, which I thought was so interesting. It was almost like the bonding that you'd done the day before hadn't happened. It's very, very interesting. So I think he was a complex character, basically.
Yes, and I have heard that he would become very much immersed in the character that he was playing, almost become that person.
Mm.
How on earth did he cope with doing multiple parts then? And how could you switch from doing one part to another if you were totally immersed?
Well,
it must have been really weird.
Yeah, well, he'd done that in Lolita, hadn't he? He played two. And he,
yeah.
I don't know if he did that before. Well, maybe he did in one of the 50s films.
I think so.
I think he
did do it before.
Yeah, definitely Lolita, possibly before.
Mm.
And, of course, he would have been inspired, I guess, by Alec Guinness doing, what was it, 8 parts in Kind Hearts and Coronets.
Absolutely. That's right. I was going to mention that because that was one of his great inspirations, wasn't it, Alec Guinness, who he played alongside... in The Lady Killers.
Ah, yes. I've never seen that, you know.
Oh, it's a fantastic film.
I know.
So you're right, yeah. So Alec Guinness plays 8 members of the Dascoyne family who get killed off one by one. And indeed, Alec Guinness plays a lady, Lady Agatha as well, a completely implausible lady, but then never mind. So yeah, he obviously relished the idea of doing many characters, so followed Guinness in that.
And why didn't he play the 4th one?
Yeah.
Tell me what you've found, because I've heard a couple of versions of that story.
Well, it was because he was supposed to play the con character, wasn't it? The guy who was in charge of the B-52 that actually goes on target.
Mm.
The actor was changed, of course. And the idea there was that the studios wanted him to play at least 4 parts, because that would be popular with the audience. Mm. He didn't want to play that particular character because he was not satisfied that he could do a Texan accent.
Mm.
But they insisted. So he apparently developed a sprained ankle.
Yeah.
Such that he couldn't get into the cockpit very easily. Well, that's the story. I'm not sure I fully believe that. I wonder when that was a bit of a way of getting out of it, but I don't know, of course.
Yeah, we're not suggesting he sprained his own ankle, but...
No.
There was a...
He was a good actor, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Oh, this ankle really hurts today. I don't know. Who knows?
Well, if he's a genius actor, he should be able to do that, shouldn't he?
Yes. Yeah.
But no, Terry Southern was raised in Texas, so he did help him with the accent. But yeah, he was insecure about it.
Mm.
He was exhausted as well. I mean, that's, you know, just playing Dr. Strangelove alone, even though it's a small part, that would be exhausting for me.
I think it would. Yeah. Can I just go back to Strangelove?
Yeah, of course.
Because we mentioned about other people like, you know, Kissinger and Herman Kahn. And there was this other guy, Edward Teller, people talk about, who was a Hungarian-American physicist, called the father of the hydrogen bomb, etc. Yeah, but, you know, he was Hungarian, he wasn't German, he'd fled from the Nazis, so, you know, it doesn't seem to fit very well. But the main thing I want to point out here is that Peter Sellers himself there's a quote here from him. Quote, Strangelove was never modelled on Kissinger. That's a popular misconception. It was always Wernher von Braun. I mean, that's pretty definitive. It was always Wernher von Braun. So,
yeah, that's pretty clear. And then obviously, as I said earlier, you know, physical traits came from other things. I've just got here, yeah, the mad scientist archetype came from the character Rot Wang in Metropolis.
That's
another film I haven't seen for years, but
no,
that's an alt media. That's another alt media favourite, isn't it? Metropolis.
Mm.
You know, I'd even forgotten. I remembered obviously the Nazi salutes, but the glove strangling him. I'd actually forgotten about that. Yeah,
that's superb.
So this film is still capable of surprising me. Yeah,
he constantly smiles as well, doesn't he, while he's talking?
Yeah, a strange smile though, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes, it is a strange smile. Yes.
Yeah.
What is it with the wheelchair? What reference is that? It seems like that's the thing to do. There's something about that that's right. But
yeah.
What was that to do with, you know?
I don't know. It feels like one of those things that's so familiar now, isn't it? That you just think, oh, yeah, of course, a madman in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
I didn't see in my notes that it was taken specifically from anything else. So
no. Oh, another thing with the hand is that there's a very famous picture, or a number of pictures actually, of Wernher von Braun with his arm in a cast. I think it's his left arm. But there are some photographs where he seems to it's sort of elevated as if he's about to do a Nazi salute. So I just wonder whether that was an influence on Peter Sellers, you know, maybe come across the photos or something. Most people, I think, say that George C. Scott was the bright shining light in this. I certainly thought he did a fantastic job. For me, it was Sterling Hayden. But George C. Scott plays General Buck Turgidson, fantastic name, as you say, the Joint Chiefs of Staff chairman. Obviously, turgid meaning boring, rather too serious about stuff. I wonder whether Buck comes from the Buck Stops here. I take the decisions and don't know.
I thought it was maybe just a very typical American name.
Could be.
From outside the context of America, you know, Buck and Chip and names like that, you know.
It could be.
Maybe a bit of an American archetype in a way. And obviously the buck is a male. It's the male connotation, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, from what you were saying earlier about these cartoony takes, it's almost a great performance inadvertently. I mean, obviously he's doing the takes, but he would have had other ideas, I guess, wouldn't he, about how he wanted to play it.
What do you mean? I don't...
Well, Kubrick got him to do these cartoony takes and ended up using them.
Yeah.
So presumably there are more serious takes that were done.
I guess so.
I mean, there are stories that he didn't talk to Kubrick for years. He was really upset with it. Maybe just in more in a sort of ego sense, because he was made to look like an idiot.
It's perfect, though, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, but I mean, he is an actor. I think years later, there's some story like years later, he sort of realised, he said, well, yeah, it did work. Okay, fair enough. But, you know, maybe he was a bit ticked off by being beaten at chess. You know, it's this whole macho.
Maybe.
I'm sure in Hollywood there's always these ego games, aren't there? So, but yeah, I've always loved him. You know, there's a film called Anatomy of a Murder. I think you're a fan of that, aren't you?
I don't know that.
That's one of his early ones. Oh, you don't know that? Right. So The Hustler, obviously. And then Patton's the big one.
Oh, Patton, yes. That's brilliant. I suppose I can.
He was a great actor.
Yeah, he was. And I can see, I suppose, why you might be annoyed as an actor, because in a sense, Kubrick was using him as a tool, like a brush. The artist might use the brush, you know, to do the painting, rather than being the director of an artist and allowing that artist to produce the work themselves. In a sense, there was a bit of that, wasn't it? It was a bit manipulative.
Yeah, but I suppose it depends how you look at it, though, because isn't the role of a director, in a sense, to manipulate the actors? And, of course, you're using manipulative in a negative sense, which is fine. But in a more sort of neutral sense, they are supposed to manipulate them, I suppose. But
it wasn't that kind of manipulation, was it? It wasn't a cooperative manipulation. It was a negative manipulation in the sense of we're just doing takes here. After we've done these takes, we'll do the real thing and we will have both learnt from your takes. But actually, I'm just going to use those takes. That's a bit of using it as a tool, I think. And it's interesting that Roger Ebert, again, the great Roger Ebert, obviously didn't know that. So he says the ticks and twitches, the grimaces, the eyebrow archings and the sardonic smiles and chewing gum. And I enjoyed the way Scott approached the role as a duet for voice and facial expression. And I'm thinking, you actually enjoyed the way that Kubrick approached the role by kidding him into doing it like that, off camera almost.
Yeah, well, of course, you know, before DVDs and special features and before the internet and essays and YouTube and everything, people just wouldn't have known all this.
Oh, no.
I mean, I suppose there's some knowledge of it, but... You know, there's other aspects to him. The whole childlike. I mean, that's what I think of him. I think of childlike. He pouts. The president sort of reprimands him and he pouts. You know, and he's chewing the gum as well. Not that that makes him a child chewing gum, but it's just the way he's doing it. You know, it's quite hilarious. I suppose Kubrick's argument to the manipulation thing would be that in the end it turned out better. And like I said, I think Scott, you know, perhaps generously a bit later in the day, you know, a few years down the line, sort of said, oh, yeah, okay.
Oh, did he? I don't know that. Is that the case?
I think he did, yeah.
Oh, he should have been proud of it, for sure. Yeah, because he did actually do it and did it extremely well. It was perfect fit, yeah.
What else have we got here? Yeah, turgid, yeah.
Sterling Hayden. I just love his characterisation there of this Brigadier General Jack D. Ripper. Jack D. Ripper? commander of this Burpleson Air Force Base, which is part of the Strategic Air Command. I just love the way that he played it and Kubrick interacted with that. Both he and Turgidson are based upon Curtis LeMay, aren't they, to a certain extent? But I think there's more of that with Jack D. Ripper, not least because Curtis LeMay was for a time in charge of Strategic Air Command. So that's a direct connection. Yeah. We'll mention more about this in a bit, I'm sure. There are some lovely shots of Jack D. Ripper giving these speeches, very serious speeches about the communists, etc. And there are some angles, aren't there? Strange camera angles where he has this sort of granite jaw, like it's a bit of fascist propaganda, and he has this cigar, just like indeed Curtis LeMay had, that he's got all the time, and it's a lovely characterization.
Yeah, I think the cigar, again, obviously is a sexual thing. There's no doubt about that. The angle is tilted to make it look longer. You've got the whole idea, I'm sure we'll get to this, of his impotence and his precious bodily fluids. But in terms of Sterling Hayden, he's got one of those voices. It's almost like Frank Sinatra delivering a song. The voice is so brilliant. It's got such gravitas. But I think Sellers gets credit as Mandrake for creating this sort of double act. Because it is really, you know, their scenes are so fantastic. Because there seems to me that it's like a weird affection between them in a funny way. But I think Sellers helps Hayden. But Hayden's, yeah, brilliant. Love that voice.
Yeah.
Straight delivery. It's just great, yeah.
Talking about the double act, you've got the over-politeness, the ridiculous over-politeness of Mandrake trying to calm him down and get that code out of him. Yeah. And yet you've got the sort of controlled manicness at the same time with the other character. It's just wonderful. This whole business, because I did read the Roger Ebert thing, and something came out was quite interesting there. People have criticized or wondered why Kubrick was concentrating on the whole fluoride thing.
Right.
You know, what was going on there? Because obviously you're laughing at this guy for thinking fluoridation of the water supply is a problem. In his case, of course, he's saying it's the communists who are fluoridating the water. Well, Roger Ebert says that this is just a bracket. He just puts this in parentheses. Younger viewers may not know that in the 1950s, this was a widespread belief. No, I don't know whether he's joking there, but if that's true, that it was talked about, oh, yeah, the communists are fluoridating our water supply. It seems to me then this is less of a criticism of people who might be worried about fluoridation than it is about people who think the communists are actually infiltrating the water supply. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I took it as quite metaphorical of, infiltration and brainwashing, essentially. That if you put fluoride in the water, you're going to change people physically, but they're also going to perhaps become more docile, you know, which is arguably how brainwashing works. But again, it's an interesting, because you and I know that in the alt media, this was one of the things that was going around, the quote conspiracy theory about fluoridation.
That's right.
I wouldn't have a clue whether that was in the air then. Obviously, I wasn't around.
Well, I mean, I have concerns about fluoridation of the water supply, and I'm very glad that in this area it's not being done. And people back then had concerns about it, obviously, but it's this connection then with the communists are doing it. I suspect that explains why Kubrick picked that.
Yes.
Because that seems less rational, doesn't it? The idea that the communists would somehow get in there and be doing this. You know, that's a more extravagant conspiracy than just, you know, the agricultural industry profiteering by dumping this stuff in the water supply. That's much more believable.
This is actually pre the era where conspiracy theory as a phrase was weaponized, because you know there was a CIA document. Well, it's around the same time, I suppose. I think it was 67. It's yet another example of people in the West do believe in conspiracies if it's the communists, if it's the Russians doing it. You know, like Russiagate, for example. You know, people do think brainwashing exists. It's just we don't do it. You know, it's just something that they do over there, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. It's just the same now with Putin's Russia as well, isn't it? You know, you can believe of them. You know, false flags are mentioned in the mainstream media. It would be, the Russians might be doing false flags. I'm thinking, hold on, you never say that about us.
Of course.
Maybe everybody does them sometimes, you know?
Yeah. As of the recording we're doing now, early March, there's a Wall Street journalist, isn't there, being held in Russia while Mr. Assange has been held for 5 years. You know, it's happening exactly the same time. And I really picked up on that because it was mentioned recently. When they do it, it's one thing. And when we do it, it's a completely other thing. You know?
That's right. Yeah, well, the whole thing about Navalny, of course, if I didn't believe for a moment that Putin had him killed. This is just far too convenient for Western propaganda and not at all convenient for Putin's point of view. But yeah, all the hoo-ha about him being murdered, and yet you've got the slow murder of Julian Assange and relative silence about that.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Yep. Can we just mention just a couple more of the cast?
Sure.
I think we've done the main ones, haven't we? I've just got
we haven't done more. Slim Pickens, of course.
Yeah, a couple of interesting things about that. As we said earlier, this was a role that was supposed to be played by Sellers. Mm. The amazing thing is that apparently Pickens arrived. Everyone thought he'd arrived in costume and in character. And they thought, blimey, he's doing a good job of that. But they didn't know that yes. that was the way he dressed and spoke anyway.
Yeah.
And I guess the other thing was that no one told him it was a comedy. Do you believe
that's
that?
Apparently
it's a good story, isn't it?
That's what I've read. Mm. Who knows?
Well, I was thinking about this. Is there actually a difference in delivering something seriously when you know it's a comedy and delivering it seriously when it's supposed to be serious?
Maybe not.
The Major Kong thing has made me think about that.
Yeah. And of course, it is true that Slim Pickens was never involved in the other scenes, was he? So he never appears, of course, in the war room.
Mm.
He never appears at Burblesham Air Force Base. So as far as he's concerned, he could have played that just straight inside the B-52 bomber, never have needed to know that was a comedy, I suppose, until the end.
Mm.
How would he think that it was not funny riding a nuclear bomb and going Yahoo and waving his hat in the air? Yeah. I mean, the at that point, surely he must have been in on it.
I suppose the only bit, that famous bit where he goes, a fella could have a great time in Dallas and they change it to Vegas.
Mm.
He's going through the kit, isn't he? And it includes things like nylon stockings. Maybe, I don't know, at that point he might have...
Maybe.
You might have said, that sounds a bit weird.
Wow.
But yeah, it's a story anyway. And then the other thing about that is that John Wayne was considered for it. And there's two stories. Either he just never replied or he turned it down. Not sure which one of those. But I don't know. John Wayne in this?
I don't think so. Certainly if he was told it was a comedy, I don't think that would have fitted with his image, would it? No.
That would be horrendous.
And of course, it's critical of America, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I don't think that would have gone down too well with it, would it? I don't know.
Yeah, if you want the most ridiculous propaganda film ever of John Wayne's, it's The Green Berets about Vietnam, made during the Vietnam.
Right.
I mean, okay, because World War II, okay, people can say, obviously, there's a very, very clear enemy and there's a clear reason to be in that war, but Vietnam is obviously not the same. But he just made a film, I think it was even filmed in Georgia or something like that, and it's so obvious it's not Vietnam. But I sort of sat through that almost for the comedy of it.
Yeah, I don't think I could bear it.
Anyway. No, okay. I watched it on your behalf. Tracy Reed, stepdaughter of Carol Reed, director of The Third Man, among other things, one of my favourite films.
All right, yes.
Yes. Yeah. And then James Earl Jones. And you can really hear, you know, he's the voice of Darth Vader, obviously. That was his first role, I believe.
And what did he do?
He was on the B-52s.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, not a huge role. I think he questions the order at some point. He's not in it for very long, but obviously had a good career after that.
I also wanted to mention Keenan Wynn, who was this Colonel Bat Guano.
Oh, I love that.
And I like the way Mandrake says, if that really is your name.
Yeah.
Always loved the way he keeps on saying, you know, you're a prevert to Mandrake. With such a serious face. And he really captures that sort of cog in the machine, following orders kind of person, doesn't he? He won't listen to reason at all. It's just he's been told to protect the base and that's it. However mad his superior has gone, he won't listen to any of it.
Yeah, and of course, Batty is, sounds like madness as well, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, Mandrake, this is part of the plot that was brilliant. Mandrake runs out of change. He's going to call the president to say that I've worked out what the code is.
Mm.
And he can't get any change. And he wants Guano to shoot the lock of the Coke machine. But he said, it's private property. It's some idea of protecting capitalism, you know, protecting private property.
Mm.
But then he does shoot it at the end. He gets a face full of Coke. Do you remember?
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Very good.
Actually, I'm not sure I like that. That was a bit too slapsticky for my mind. That was a bit
too much.
Yeah. A bit of the pie fight that they decided to scrap.
Maybe.
At the end.
But again, it's the earnestness, isn't it, of protecting the Coke machine.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yeah, and I love the idea that you're obeying the letter of the law. This is private property. It doesn't matter that the world is about to be blown up. You're sticking to your guns, literally. Yeah.
Well, that's quite a comedy thing as well, isn't it? Someone sticking to their principles, even when it's going to have dire consequences.
Yes, it is.
That's definitely a trait. You could talk about Monty Python, you know. I've never seen them publicly say it, but they obviously took a lot from this.
Oh, yeah, the satire of it, absolutely.
Yeah, the satire, the cartoonish authority figures. I mean, there's a clear line from this to other things, you know. Just brilliant. Perhaps we could just mention briefly why this was a comedy. I guess we haven't said that, have we?
No.
Got a Kubrick quote, in fact. Always nice to get a direct quote from the man himself.
Mm.
Quote, my idea of doing it as a nightmare comedy came in the early weeks of working on the screenplay. I found that in trying to put meat on the bones and to imagine the scenes fully, I had to keep leaving out of it things which were either absurd or paradoxical in order to keep it from being funny.
Mm.
These things seem to be close to the heart of the scenes in question.
Yes.
But yeah, it was just the idea that... it got more and more comedic, and in the end, Kubrick just gave in.
Yes, because he started off not thinking of it as a comedy at all, did he?
Absolutely.
He was sort of vaguely thinking about making a thriller about a Cold War nuclear accident. Mm. And more he thought about it, the more he became aware that, as you say, so many paradoxes.
Yeah.
The whole thing about the balance of terror, you know, it was just so paradoxical that he thought, you know, I'm either going to cut everything out or I've got to go satirical with it.
Mm.
And he was alerted to this novel, wasn't he? A novel called Red Alert.
Mm.
It had a different title, as I said before, by Peter George, who obviously worked with Terry Southern and Stanley Kubrick on this. That book was recommended to Kubrick by a guy who was the head of the Institute for Strategic Studies, which is a British think tank in international affairs.
Mm.
So there were lots of conversations going on behind the scenes, including with Herman Kahn,
yeah.
We've already mentioned, we'll talk about a bit more. Lost the point I was trying to make there.
So yeah, he was thinking...
Yeah, so the point was that all that was not comedic, was it? That was a serious novel. So although that was kind of the basis for it, because I believe, although I've not read it, but most of that is in fact the same as the screenplay. As you say, there's no Dr. Strangelove in it. There's no doomsday device. And I think the tragedy is averted at the end. But apart from that, it's pretty much the same, although not funny. But Kubrick obviously felt that he just couldn't do it without going in a comedy direction.
Mm.
I'm glad he did. So glad he did.
Yeah, there is some debate about how much Terry Southern actually contributed.
Hmm.
He'd made this comic novel where there's a magic Christian and there was also one called Candy. Candy is an awful film, but it's got a sort of ironic, so bad it's good sort of cachet nowadays.
Hmm.
Peter George disputes how much Southern contributed, that maybe he was brought in towards the end. Because one of the popular stories, and you know how these stories change over time, is that he said to Kubrick, oh, it's got to be a comedy. But that seems to have been refuted, that Kubrick had the idea already.
Oh, okay.
Obviously, Terry Southern was a very good guy to have on board to make the comedy aspects. But that was the story. And then the other story that I think I'd heard years ago that may or may not be correct is that, well, I know there was a film being made called Failsafe, which did come out just after Strangelove, I believe. And that was like the film that Strangelove was going to be. So one of the stories was that when Kubrick learned that this was in production, he realized, oh, I've got to do something different. Otherwise, you're just going to get two films which are very similar coming out.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, he actually ended up, it's a bit complicated, but he ended up hitting them with a lawsuit, which made sure that Strangelove came out before Failsafe.
Right, okay, yeah. It rings a bell, but I didn't follow that one because I thought it was too convoluted to go into.
Mm.
As we're talking about the comedy aspect of this, I understand that one idea, which was ditched, was to approach this as seeing it through the eyes of aliens from outer space.
Mm.
I don't quite know how that would have worked. I think of the mashed potato adverts with all the robots, made of saucepans and things laughing at what the humans are doing. I don't know whether it would have been a bit like that. Seeing it from an outer space point of view, they ditched it. I'm glad they did, really, because it would have made it less black, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think what's lovely is that they didn't put it in, but now with the internet and so forth, we know that that was an idea.
Mm.
So we could at least revel in the idea of it, even though I think I agree with you.
Mm.
I don't think it was the best. Now, the idea was that it would start and end with them.
Ah.
I suppose, again, it works as a kind of, if you think of it more metaphorically, it's the way that when you're outside of a situation, you can see how ridiculous it is.
Yeah, yeah.
So not a bad idea.
No, I just don't think...
Did we mention the pie fight? Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I just don't think it would have worked. Yeah, as you say, yeah, the pie fight is in the same vein, isn't it? Again, so glad that they ditched that as well.
Yeah.
So this would have been right at the end, is that right? Where they would have been all in the war room and they'd have been picking up all this food and chucking it at each other.
That's it.
They did do it, didn't they?
I think they did.
Because I think it was decided that you couldn't see who was who, you couldn't see what was going on, and people, of course, were laughing and et cetera. So the whole sort of atmosphere would have been ruined, I think.
Yeah.
So.
again, it's so nice because we've got stills of it.
Ah.
Because it's not a bad idea. It's just like the aliens are maybe not the best.
Mm.
Yeah, there were a couple of stories. Everyone was taking it a bit too seriously. We call them sort of custard pies in England, don't we? They call them cream pies in America. There was so much that you couldn't see who was who. And the other thing was one of the characters says, when the president gets hit with a cream pie, one, I think it's Turgidson, says, gentlemen, our leader has been cut off in his prime.
Oh, yes.
And, I didn't mean that as a clumsy segue, Julian. Yeah, because of obviously JFK had just been killed. That was felt to be in poor taste. So they changed that, along with that line about having a good weekend in Dallas.
That's right, yes. So they did, in fact, delay the release of this film as well, didn't they? The first test screening was scheduled for the very day of the assassination, as it turns out.
Yeah, and I saw a still online.
And then they,
oh, sorry, go on.
Yeah, and then they thought, hey, can we actually release this in December? It's a bit soon, so they waited till January the next year to release it.
Yeah, I saw a still online that says preview screening, and it's weirdly chilling, isn't it? It's like anything that happens on 9/11. You know, it takes on a chilling quality because it was such a traumatic day, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, just one more thing I want to add about the comedy aspect. Kubrick became friends with Joseph Heller, who wrote Catch-22, one of my favourite novels. Came out in 61, so no doubt Kubrick read it, and I'm sure took inspiration, and they were friends. And they had some dialogues. They talked for a long time, Kubrick and Joseph Heller. And one of the things Kubrick said to Heller is, things have much more impact if the audience discovers it for themselves. So he said the worst way to communicate anything is directly. Probably agree with that. If people discover things for themselves, not to say that the comedy is particularly subtle, didn't mean it like that, but as a general Kubrick sort of piece of wisdom, I think.
Right. Well, yeah, I've got an exact example of this because obviously at the Burpleson Air Force Base, you've got that huge billboard that says peace is our profession. Beautifully Orwellian. And I thought, oh, what a great idea to stick that up. You know, that's a good joke. Then when I looked at Strategic Air Force Command's shield, it's their motto. It's a real thing. Kubrick, as it were, didn't tell me that. I had to find that out. So there was an extra frisson from that. Oh, wow, it's true after all. That's even funnier.
Oh, you know? There you go. It's the magic of podcasting. You've just validated what I said.
Yeah. I've actually got it here. Nuclear deterrent force. Right. So there's this shield and it's got a hand in armor and that hand has got bolts of lightning coming out of it. But it's also grasping, I think, what must be an olive branch for peace. And it says Strategic Air Command and by the side of it, peace is our profession. Wonderful.
Orwellian, as you said. Beautiful.
Yeah. Now, I've got a few more of these satire things I've got to mention before we leave the idea of comedy here. It occurred to me, you know, when Ripper reaches for his machine gun, he pulls it out of a golf club bag, doesn't he?
Oh, I've forgotten about that.
And is that to say, like, war is, like, just a game for him? Or is it, like, when he plays golf, that's as serious as war? I don't know. It's
yeah. It's either way, equating the two. It's just in a day's work, isn't it?
Yes.
It is, for these guys, war is a day's work, you know? The business of either proposing wars or planning wars or, you know.
It's his whole life. It's his work and his recreation.
That's it. That's it, yeah. Which is which? Yeah. Which one follows the other, yeah. Oh, that's a great touch, yeah.
And with the other thing here, which we'll probably go with the music actually later, and the theme to do with sex, of course, the wonderful air refueling that we have right at the beginning of the film with that sort of Mantovani-style orchestral music. And you've got this refueling going on. It's like a love scene. And wasn't that Curtis LeMay who developed the idea of having these bombers in constant motion needing to be refueled?
Oh, I'm not sure.
I think it might be.
Sounds about right.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, the last time I watched this, I found more and more sexual references. I mean, obviously, Kong riding the bomb. I'm sure there's more, yeah.
Oh, I found it out, by the way. The music at the beginning that goes with that refueling love scene is the song Try a Little Tenderness.
Oh, that's it.
From the 1930s. And the lyrics go, oh, she may be weary. Them young girls, they do get wearied wearing that same old miniskirt dress. But when she gets weary, you try a little tenderness.
Yeah, oh, try a little tenderness, that's right. Johnny comes marching home. He's like...
That's from the American Civil War.
Oh, is that from the Civil War? Right, yeah.
Yeah.
And I was saying to you before we started, wasn't it, of using jaunty music in a serious scenario. Obviously, we've got We'll Meet Again. I think that's genius.
Yes.
Do you know what they were originally going to do? You know those bouncing balls you used to get with karaoke? Where the,
yes,
the ball bounces on the word that you're supposed to be singing. Yeah, apparently they were going to have that as well. That was another idea.
Oh, were they?
Which, again, probably pleased they didn't, but I'm happy that I know that. You know, it's one of those.
That does appeal to me, actually.
Yeah.
But yes, it's in the vein of the other things.
And Kubrick would later on in his career, in a couple of cases, do something slightly similar. So in The Shining, you've got all this Ray Noble orchestra music sung by Al Bowley, you know, Midnight. Which is a kind of jaunty in its way and doesn't fit with...
No.
Doesn't seem to fit, but it makes it more horrific. And then in Full Metal Jacket, at the very end, the soldiers are marching and they're singing the Mickey Mouse theme, which I didn't really know, but it was M-I-C-K-E-Y-M-O-U-S-E, with a sort of military beat almost. So it's just an example of juxtaposition, isn't it?
You know? Yeah, it's the irony, isn't it?
It's the irony, yeah, exactly.
And it's either the irony in the music or the irony in the words. And I think with the When Johnny Comes Marching Home, it's less in the music, isn't it? Because that seems to fit the da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It fits with the, you know, the bombers are going, you know.
Yeah.
It's the words, though, isn't it? When Johnny comes marching home again, hurrah, hurrah, we'll give him a hearty welcome and we'll all feel gay when Johnny comes home. No, you won't, because everybody's going to be dead.
Yeah.
Wonderful irony there.
Yeah.
And, of course, the same with the Vera Lynn singing We'll Meet Again, which was suggested, I believe, by Spike Milligan. Of course, Sellers' mate, of course. So, again, you know, We'll Meet Again, and then this lovely don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Yeah, so it's the irony of the words, isn't it?
Oh,
yeah,
brilliant.
Although in the first case, the irony of the words and the music, the lovely Mantovani gentleness of this killing machine being refueled. Yeah.
What about the elongated lettering? Do you remember that at the beginning and the credits?
Yes. Lovely, isn't it?
Was there some story to do with that?
I don't know, but I just so characteristic and so individual, but I love it. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose something about elongation is just telling you that things aren't quite right or things aren't quite in proportion, something like that. I don't know.
Mm.
You know, obviously it's a deliberate choice. Maybe it just means that every character is over the top, you know, is slightly cartoonish. Yeah, I don't know what's in it, but there's something there.
Yes, there's a cartoonishness about it. And we've got to credit Laurie Johnson. We did mention, but Laurie Johnson, English band leader, composer, arranger, conductor, obviously did a lot of arranging of this stuff insofar as he was not using his own music. He'd done an awful lot of stuff, TV themes like Animal Magic, The Avengers, The New Avengers, This Is Your Life, The Professionals, and loads of films as well. Moonraker, First Man on the Moon, loads of concert music, theatre music, etc. So, you know, a major figure in English music. Perfect choice for this.
Julian, before we leave the comedy, I think we already have, but will you permit me my one Yes, Prime Minister reference? Because it will make you laugh.
Oh!
It will make you laugh.
Hopefully. It wouldn't be you without that.
Yes, yes. In other podcasts, it's Beatles references, but this one... now, there's a fantastic episode. Again, it must have been influenced by this film. I can't see how it wouldn't. But there's an episode where Hacker has just become Prime Minister, and they're talking about obviously pushing the nuclear button and what are the implications, what are the safety features to stop, you know, someone blowing up the world. And he's trying to order lunch and it turns out he can't get his lunch delivered or something. And he says to his wife, oh, so I've got the power to blow up the world, but I've got the power to order scrambled eggs.
That's it.
It's not funny when I say it, but it's just the idea that, you know, they've obviously taken this idea. It's the absurdity, you know, of the nuclear button. You know, it's serious stuff, obviously, but...
Right. Yeah, the power and powerlessness. This will be a theme that comes out later in our discussion, sure.
I think so, yeah.
I wanted to say just a little bit more about Herman Kahn, who wrote that book on thermonuclear war and was in consultation with Kubrick and others about this film. Because I think he must have had quite an influence. The Doomsday Machine, we've already mentioned, was in his book, a sort of logical conclusion to mutually assured destruction. But also, there's some mention about the possibility of people living in bunkers under the earth as well. A couple of quotes from here. I got this off Google Books, so this is page 518. Usually when I discuss expensive programs that involve elaborate shelters, I find that people are appalled at the idea of living underground for such lengthy periods as posed here. Blah, 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 because I haven't got access to the full book. But yes, yeah, it's part of his book there. And again, with the Doomsday Machines, he's saying, I'm not predicting, this is page 500, I'm not predicting they will be built. I've already indicated in my opinions to be the opposite. It is most unlikely that either the Soviet Union or the US would build such machines. However, and then he goes on with the discussion, but I understand that the Soviets did not exactly, as far as I understand anyway, not actually build a machine, but they did have a system called Dead Hand at one point. Did you come across this?
No, I didn't actually, no. No.
Right, so I've got a quote here from this great essay by Eric Schlosser called Almost Everything in Dr. Strangelove Was True.
Oh, yeah.
This is in the New Yorker. So this is from the 17th of January, 2014. And there's loads of stuff in here, but he does talk about Dead Hand. So a bit of a quote from here. A decade after the release of Strangelove, the Soviet Union began work on the perimeter system. And then he goes on to say that it had a nickname, Dead Hand, obviously in Russian, and that it could allow junior military officials to make nuclear decisions if they couldn't get hold of the top Soviet top brass. Mm. And then if Dead Hand sensed unexpected nuclear explosions inside the Soviet Union, then it would basically chuck nukes at the US.
Whoa.
So there was something along those lines. Mm. You know, Khan was right. You know, there was a logical conclusion that would lead in that direction. And it was kept secret as well. It was kept secret. Just like, you know, in the film, it's kept secret. Somebody says, well, is it Strangelove says? So the other side would have to know about this for it to have a deterrent effect.
Yeah. Why didn't you tell them?
That's right.
Why didn't you tell the world?
Yeah. So it turns out so much of it was true.
Wow. When was the book that you were quoting from? When was that written?
On Thermonuclear War was 1960. Mm. So it was fresh off the press, really, when Kubrick was chatting with him.
Mm. Wow, very interesting.
How much was known to Khan, I don't know. But people around the time, this is according to Eric Schlosser, people around the time were criticising the film for being dangerous, evil, Soviet propaganda, implausible, impossible on a dozen counts, all these sorts of things. And then
that means it's true, isn't it? Is it? Never believe anything until it's officially denied, Julian.
Yes, that's right. It seems that Eisenhower did, in fact, agree to let American officers use their nuclear weapons in an emergency if there wasn't time for the president to be contacted.
Yeah.
And it was known as Single Integrated Operational Plan, or PSYOP.
Such an interesting acronym there.
Yeah, yeah. He was very unhappy that he'd signed this into being, but he had.
Oh, wow.
He was worried that something foolish down the chain of command could happen.
Oh, oh, amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there is some idea, as I said, in the alt media that Kubrick did know quite a bit, you know, about the deep state.
Mm.
Not because he had necessarily secret sources, probably just because he read a lot, because the truth is always out there, isn't it?
I think that's right, yes.
According to Dan Richter, you know, he confirmed that Kubrick, in preparation, would read 50 books or whatever. He'd want to become an expert on everything.
Mm. But he was also consulting with people who were in a position to know things that ordinary people wouldn't know. I think that's also true.
Yes.
Mm.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Yeah.
So, yeah, he's a very knowledgeable person, obviously.
Mm. And wasn't there a thing about the inside of the B-52s was so accurate that they were worried about getting sued or something?
That is right. Yes, yeah. Yes. The story goes that they had some sort of photograph or something of the inside, but it was not very good. And then they sort of deduced what it would be like by comparing it with another type of aircraft or something along those lines. But yeah, they got some people from the Air Force, were invited to come and look at the set or something.
Mm.
And they went, wow, this is totally accurate. And
yeah, that's it. Yeah.
They were freaked out the FBI might be investigating them.
That's right.
You know, I don't know whether that's a cover story or whether they did in fact have some intelligence they shouldn't have had. We'll never know.
Yeah, it's not beyond the realms of possibility. I mean,
it's not.
Kubrick was a name by then, you know, and who knows?
And he had all these contacts. And
yeah.
Was it his version of the Peter Sellers sprained ankle?
Yes.
Maybe. Don't know, of course. Yeah.
Wouldn't put it past him. Yeah, we're not making any allegations, anybody.
Of course not, because we don't know. Sure.
No. we're here to serve the listener and get them to do their own research as well as listening
to us. Exactly. Exactly. Can I just say a couple more things about this reality thing before we leave that subject? It's just that I've got a lovely quote here. Well, I haven't sourced it myself, but again, from this article, he says there was a memo that went to Kennedy very shortly after Kennedy came into office. And the quote is, a subordinate commander faced with a substantial military action could start the thermonuclear holocaust on his own initiative if he could not reach you. Right. You know, that was the situation that Kennedy inherited from Eisenhower. And so he ordered locks to be put on these weapons that were coded. So hence we get this business about the code, you know, that Jack Ripper was hiding inside his mind. They were called permissive action links. That's right, PALs. So although these were put on NATO devices.
PALs.
Yeah, PALs, that's it.
Oh, perfect, isn't it?
It is. Against, I might add, the advice of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who said, quote, all is well with the atomic stockpile program and there's no need for any changes. So they wanted to remain in control of the situation. There were apparently all kinds of lacks of control over the weaponry. So although, you know, we were told this is all ridiculous, you know, there's no truth to this at all, something like that could have happened because there was so little control over that stockpile. Quite remarkable, isn't it?
Oh, it's amazing, isn't it? So much to discover.
Absolutely. It's a great article. I recommend everybody to read that through. Of course, I can't vouch for everything that's in it, but it's a great article. So Eric Schlosser, almost everything in Dr. Strangelove was true, from The New Yorker.
I'll have to read that. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you want to say something about the set? I can't remember.
We were talking about the B-52s a bit earlier. So the sets, yeah. So Ken Adam, I was a huge Bond fan. Not so much now. I still like the old films, but
yeah.
Growing up, James Bond films were just so much part of my life. And he sort of made his name in the very first film, Dr. No, the villain's lair. Ken Adam had come up with this wonderful set.
Right.
Obviously, Kubrick had seen that, got in touch with him, and he did, I don't know if he did other Kubrick films. I imagine he did, but he did later Bond films. And there's that large table in the middle of the war room, lit by lamps, and Kubrick wanted it to be covered with green baize.
Yes.
Makes me think of snooker, but actually it was more to do with poker.
Yes, that's right.
And we said right at the beginning about the black and white, obviously you can't really see that. Are we supposed to just pick up on it anyway? I don't know.
No.
But
I think what I read that was the idea was it was to make the actors feel like they were in a poker game.
Ah, yes.
To affect the way they approached it.
A game of poker for the fate of the world, yeah. Absolutely. The big board took 10 miles of electric cable to light it. It's one of those juicy little technical details. What do you think of the war room?
Oh, I loved it.
Yeah.
Again, I've not seen Metropolis, but that comes up again. Apparently that was inspired by the sort of expressionist style of that sci-fi movie. So this is Fritz Lang's movie from the 1920s. I must say, I've got a DVD of it, but I've never seen it. But he was trying to evoke that.
I feel like it might be one of those films, Metropolis, where the impact of it might be better than the film.
Maybe.
I've seen it a couple of times. It's not bad, but I think you'll pick up on a lot of stuff that's quite prescient in it. So, yes, you should watch that for your film education, if nothing else.
Yes, I will.
Yeah, and it's a great set and the vastness of it. I mentioned earlier the point where Dr. Strangelove suddenly turns up. For some reason, that really struck me the last time I watched it. So Merkin Muffley, they're having a chat. He says, Dr. Strangelove. And then they suddenly cut to the other end of the room. And out of nowhere, you've just suddenly got this incredible character.
Yes. Yeah. Out of the darkness, indeed.
Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic set.
Out of the darkness of Nazi Germany, he comes into the light of the Western Allies. Another thing about remarkable about these sets is that it's just basically three sets, isn't it?
Right.
You don't really feel the need for locations and other sets, do you? It's all very tight and that's all you need.
How many locations? So you've got inside the B-52s, we've got Turgidson and his girlfriend at the beginning. But I mean, that's very brief, isn't it?
Oh, that's true. Yes, you're right. There is
I mean, it's so brief, but you're right. Yeah, it's just the Burpleson Air Force Base and the war room. Yeah, that's pretty much it, isn't it?
Three main sets.
Yeah.
Yeah, and a corridor. Yeah, so there are some sort of little satellite sets, but those three main things, you don't feel the need for much more. Quite minimalist.
I don't know. I think it's just simple storytelling, really, isn't it?
Yeah. It is.
Well, this film is getting better the more we talk about it, actually. So thank you for that.
Okay, let's talk about themes and things we can learn from it. Obviously, the main theme is this Cold War satire, mutually assured destruction, etc. And the sexual thing is there, which I think is basically the sublimation, would you agree, of sexual things into warfare, playing with that,
yes,
that psychoanalytical way of looking at things, maybe Freudian way of looking at things. I'm picking up that people say, you know, there's too much of this in terms of the analysis of this film. Maybe there is. Maybe it is overemphasized, but it's still very much there because we know that Kubrick himself actually wrote about this. So there's a quote from a book called The Stanley Kubrick Archives, published in 2008 by Alison Castle. And this is what Kubrick said, as quoted in this book. Hold on, the background to this is from Wikipedia, actually. In the months following the film's release, director Stanley Kubrick received a fan letter from LeGrasse G. Benson of the Department of History of Art at Cornell University, interpreting the film as being sexually layered. And the director wrote back to Benson and confirmed the interpretation. So this is now the quote from the book. Quote, seriously, you are the first one who seems to have noticed the sexual framework from intromission, brackets, the planes going in, to the last spasm, brackets, Kong's ride down and detonation at target. So there you go, from the horse's mouth. There is actually a framework of sexuality to the whole thing.
Yeah.
So you can't miss that out.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Yeah,
I don't know whether I need to actually mention these sexual things, but they're so obvious, aren't they? Obviously, the refueling at the beginning. Somebody's reading Playboy magazine, aren't they?
Yes.
In the B-52. You've got Ripper's, I think, impotence.
Yes.
You've got the lust that Turgeson has got. Obviously, he's got a secretary who's saying, I'll marry you one day kind of thing, but he's really committed to war, so it's all about lust, really. Mm. And, of course, Strangelove is hankering after this idea of an underground harem of perfect women.
10-to-1 ratio.
Sorry?
Yeah, 10-to-1 ratio of females to males in the underground.
Yes, that's it. That's it. But and the final bomb, of course. Yeah.
But even just the name Strangelove, in some weird way, it's passed me by all these years. Just Strangelove.
Yes.
How weird is that, you know?
Absolutely, yeah.
Even that.
I suppose the lust for war instead of human love is a kind of strange love, isn't it?
it is. Mm. But yeah, I suppose it's a bit maybe a bit on the nose to say that people make war to cover up some sort of sexual inadequacy, but
well,
maybe in a general way just to cover some sort of inadequacy, I don't know.
Sure. I'm not a great Freudian, I have to say. I think it's rather overblown. I think he was rather overblown, to be honest, but I'm not saying there's nothing to it. The point is I suspect that Kubrick himself was influenced by those kinds of thoughts and then decided to use them for the film, you know. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
A well-read man, you know.
But of course, when you make it comedy as well, you're sort of distancing yourself from it in a way. It's almost like, well, I'm telling you something that could be true, but because it's comedy, I'm not telling you have to take it seriously. You know what I mean? So
absolutely, yes.
You can almost like deliver the truth via the back door in a funny way.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I want to talk about, you know, the lessons we can sort of learn from it, how we can ruminate upon this. I'm going to credit this documentary because you sent it to me and I think it's got a lot that's good in it. So it's influenced my thinking and your thinking, although I do have some reservations about some aspects of it. But it's called Learning to Love the Bomb, a retrospective on Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove. So this is by a YouTube channel called Empire of the Mind. Be a link to that, of course. Very good, I think. I'm not so sure about his concentration so much on mythology towards the end. I don't know to what extent Kubrick was influenced by Kierkegaard and other philosophers he mentions, but never mind. There are lots of good ideas in here, so I am crediting that documentary. So one of the ideas that he brings up is the fact that in the comedy of this, Kubrick is exploring paradox, having noticed that that is a feature of the actual situation, of course, with mutually assured destruction, and therefore going for satire and comedy because of those paradoxes. And one of the things I've got from this is that things that are paradoxical and things that are ironic are almost unbelievable. Could these things really happen? Of course, we've talked about it, so we know they could really happen. But, you know, so many people were saying at the time, well, this is not realistic, this couldn't happen, it's too paradoxical, it's too ironic. But isn't that a bit of a sobering thought? Because if you approach something and think these paradoxes are such that, well, they couldn't really be like that in real life, that sort of makes us ill-equipped to stop such things happening, if you get my meaning.
So what you're saying is, if you see something as comedy, it's a way of dismissing it? Is that what you mean?
I don't think I put it. I need to try this again. I'm not sure I put that very well, actually. Let me try again.
Okay.
I've got the answer to this. It's the phrase, truth is stranger than fiction. Mm. And this film shows that, isn't it? It demonstrates that truth is stranger than fiction. It's fiction, but it's true in a way, in that it, you know, it's exploring something that could have happened. So we need to keep in our minds. That's what I'm saying. I think what I'm learning from this is that we all need to realize that truth can be really stranger than fiction. So we shouldn't dismiss something because it has, oh, it's a little bit too fanciful. We must think, hold on, this might be true. Yeah, it's a bit fanciful, but actually things like that can happen. That's what I'm taking from it.
Yeah. Well, that goes back to, you know, I mentioned Bill Hicks a lot. He had this sort of sleep tight narrative in the sense of saying, don't worry, everyone, sleep tight. The government's in control. You know, nothing this crazy could possibly be true. It just comes back to that old thing, you know. We weren't going to mention the fact that it's a 10-year anniversary of when you unleashed me onto the world, Julian.
Oh, did I?
And I think 10 years ago, we were probably having a similar discussion.
Yes, we probably were.
But yeah. There's so much to be learned. And like you said, when something's ironic, it's so far from what you consider the norm. Yeah. But yeah, we can learn from that. The world is very bizarre.
Yes. It doesn't mean that all bizarre things are true, but it does mean that some bizarre things can be true. So we should constantly keep that in mind and not just say anything that's bizarre is false. No. Case by case basis. Yeah.
What about the rather dangerous lesson that the people in charge of our lives and in charge of the nuclear button might be slightly buffoony or...
Well, yes.
Or might be mad. You know, I mean, that is a dangerous thought even for someone like me.
Yeah.
You know.
I can't think of anybody who I'd like to be in charge of a nuclear button, even if they had to consult with other people first before it was pressed, you know. Some more than others, but I can't think of anybody I would actually like. No, certainly not myself.
Yes, yes.
Or a system. Gosh, what a dreadful thought it is.
Especially people who want to be in power. That's the other thing
yes.
to say, isn't it?
That's right.
Apparently there are tribes that will elect as leader the person that doesn't want to be leader.
Right.
Because they suspect they're going to be less power hungry than the other ones.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, yes.
So, yeah. I haven't really got any more if you want to wrap up. I don't know.
Oh, well, I had this idea that is explored in that documentary. I think it's got something to it. Is the idea of the modern world. Of course, we see this mutually assured destruction as a feature of the modern world, leading to impotence, which of course connects to the sexual symbolism in the film. And I think there's something to that, in that when you create massive systems, interconnected, complex systems, it can lead in the direction of a certain impotence, because how do you control something that is massive, interconnected and interdependent? And we have an example of that in the film. They've created this system, but once the weaknesses of that system are revealed through this mad person making these decisions, you can't stop it. Once it's triggered, that's it. So there's a sense of disempowerment about creating systems which are supposed to give you power. They kind of take away decision making. There's an inflexibility about them once they're made. I think it is a feature of the modern world.
What do you do without a system, though? That's the thing.
Well, I think you try to avoid making totalizing systems and global systems and top-down systems.
Right.
I'm all for trying to keep control at the local level. You know, we had this with the so-called pandemic, didn't we, where it's this is the approach, you know? We all wear masks and we all take vaccines and we all lock down, and the WHO wants to have more of this kind of thing, you know, to have control. It's all about controlling from the top so that nothing goes wrong. And I'm thinking, no, exactly what we needed throughout was flexibility at the grassroots level so that individual circumstances could be coordinated appropriately. Doctors can make individual decisions in consultation with their patients instead of being risked being struck off because they're making a decision that went against the policy, you know. Or perhaps individual councils making a particular decision about what they do with their elderly people. Do they let other people go to work? Or maybe they think, yeah, that's the way to go about it, you know. Whatever it is, I think it would have been so much better if there could have been flexibility in the approach.
Well,
that's just one example.
Well, yeah, looking forward, of course, AI, you're going to get even less of a human approach.
Yeah.
Not saying it's not good for some things, but yeah. You're absolutely right. I always think this when, if I'm a victim of some terrible bureaucracy,
right,
which is actually happening with a company I'm working for. They're a French company, and I teach online for them. And the French authorities have come up with some idea that you... this is a brilliant piece of it in an unintended comedy. They've decided that the only teachers that can work for this company are ones that live in France, even though the whole idea of being able to teach remotely is that you could live anywhere.
Oh, okay.
That's quite a brilliant piece of unintentional comedy, isn't it?
Yes.
But yeah,
yes.
But yes. I was talking to the owner of my school. I was saying to him, is this a human being that's made this decision? When you think of bureaucracies, I don't know if you think like this as well, obviously, there's some human involvement in bureaucracies, but it is kind of like a machine, isn't it? It's like even if it's not technically a robot, probably is at some point now, but, you know, it's weird, isn't it? When the machine, inverted commas, makes a decision, like a bureaucratic machine, there must be a human hand at some point.
It's interesting you bring up the bureaucratization thing, because that's in a quote from this David Bromwich article I've got here. He says that... the deep preoccupation of Dr. Strangelove is in fact not war itself, but rather the political development of which modern war has been the largest system. And then he just says, the bureaucratization of terror. And that's mostly what it's about, isn't it? The system, rather than war itself, the creation of these systems that can destroy us because of their inflexibility and their vulnerability to human error and human hubris and human stupidity and human ignorance, and we need that flexibility that responds to the situation, not a system.
Isn't it interesting that shortly before this film was made, just a few years, Eisenhower made the famous military industrial complex speech, which I didn't hear until I saw it on alt media documentary probably 15 years ago. But as of this film, it was already out there, but obviously people wouldn't have known that phrase. But that's the machine, of course, as well.
Yeah.
Did you have anything else in your notes that you wanted to get to?
Perhaps a couple more things about this idea of the machine and the small slip-up that can be the end of everything. I mean, we had that, what we were talking about before, with the Cuban Missile Crisis and the rules of engagement and all that kind of thing. You know, there were slip-ups, weren't there? There were stupid things that people did, and it could have been the end of the world. And as it happened, it was not, which I think is providential. But there you go. These rules created a sort of machine, and there was the small slip-up that could have happened. And this film certainly explores that. And I think it goes, as you say, AI, technocracy, globalized systems. It's terrifying that we could end up with analogs of that as we go forward from here. And they are, again, also really subject to human nature, if not by being vulnerable to decisions that people make when the machine exists, then vulnerable to, as it were, being front-loaded by human stupidity in the very creation of these things.
Do you think AI is an unstoppable machine now, in the sense that it's here now, isn't it? I mean,
I don't know.
Oh, I wish I had answers. That's a problem.
Yeah, I think the only answer, to repeat myself a bit, is just to resist all these totalizing processes and trends as much as we possibly can. And every time the WEF suggests that they can be in control of everything and erect this wonderful technocracy for the world, to say, no, I don't really want to be part of that. Thanks very much. I'll grow my own vegetables, or, you know, go to the local store and pay with cash, and all these little things that we can do that resist the direction they want us to go in. Because however much they think they're in control, their machine just will not work.
Yeah, it's interesting. I work in a retail. I have a part-time, it's a currency exchange. I mean, you do sometimes talk to the customers. And because they can pay by cash or card, I do find myself sometimes mentioning cashless society. You know, because sometimes you just have a little chat with them before you give them your money and stuff. It's interesting to gauge people's opinions. And I think so many people, this is true with also scanners in supermarkets, you know, the gadget. I've never used it, to be honest, because I'm trying to stay a bit old school. But these devices you can use, people go mad when they go down in the shop, because there was a thing at Christmas, the system broke down and no one could use their scanners, and I mean they were really angry. And
yes, that's it.
I think all these machines often get sold to the public with convenience, don't they?
Oh, they do, absolutely.
And I mean, I hear this all the time, and I talk to my family about it and stuff. unfortunately, X amount of people, they just love convenience, you know, and I do in a lot of ways, you know.
And I'm not being Luddite about this, you know, to use that typical view of the Luddites. But, you know, no technology is neutral, and we just need to see, well, hold on, is technology and scientific progress necessarily progress with a big P, you know? I mean, I could look at growing my own vegetables in the garden as being progress, in the sense that maybe that's a better thing to do tomorrow than just to mindlessly buy things from the supermarket all the time. Well, that's progress. But that's not how it's normally looked upon, is it? It always has to be technological and has to be, you know, convenience and all that. But why? What does progress really mean? And I think we need to look at, when we come to technology, is to say, is this the kind of progress I want? Is this really going to help me and other people? If it is, fine, use it. If not, step back from it. It's not neutral. It's not necessarily progress just because it's bright, shining, and convenient. So it's not being against all technology. It's engaging with it critically and asking those questions. I think we all need to do that.
Yeah. Is that a paradox or irony that progress to you and to me is growing your own vegetables, which is going back to the beginning? That's a paradox.
Yeah,
I think that's both, isn't it?
It is a bit paradoxical, isn't it? Yeah, yeah.
No, definitely.
It's always asking, what does it mean, isn't it? You know, what does progress really mean? We're told what progress means. It means buying the latest gadget. It means being online. You know, it means giving up cash or whatever it is. Well, maybe it isn't. Maybe it isn't. It just means being better in some way than the previous day. Well, that could be in any direction you like, and that will be depending upon each individual's choices and circumstances. It's better for me now to be writing on a paper pad because it's more convenient for me. It's better for me sometimes to pick up a real book because I just love the pages and the feel of them.
Me too.
That's progress, isn't it?
Yeah. But society, you see, all these things, we can argue whether these are deliberate or not. All these things are built into society where people will make fun of you for that.
Yeah.
For using paper and wanting to use cash.
That's right.
And I don't know exactly where that comes from. I think it's partly inevitable, partly planted. I don't have any evidence for that. But you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. It's
the majority.
Difficult to analyse the full story. Yeah.
It's the majority. We always say this, don't we? We don't want to sound patronising, but I see this in my everyday life. It's not something I've just made up, that the majority of people seem to just value convenience, and they think progress is what they're told progress is.
Yes.
As we said.
Yes.
And that when you regress, you know, if you go back to writing letters, you know, imagine if someone writes a letter and posts it to you. A lot of people would say, you're a bit of a weirdo, aren't you, writing letters? But I think they're lovely, you know. Equally, I enjoy emails because they're convenient. So
yeah.
I think what you're saying is, you know, finding some sort of balance.
Yes.
And I think backlashes do happen. I could see in the future a possible backlash against smartphones, for example. Probably not a complete. I think there's still going to be people camping outside Apple or whatever when the latest iPhone comes out. I think they're still going to happen. Equally, I think people are still going to always want to go to parks and things like that and meet real people. You know, because obviously we lived through the COVID era, you probably call it now. You know, we learned lots of things, you know, and I kind of had my ear to the ground even though I was locked inside. And I think you're always going to get that spectrum of people who do like organic things, be it food or things like organic conversations, let's say.
Yes.
So I don't know, but I think there could be a backlash.
I think there could.
I'm almost holding out hope for that.
And one of the roots of backlash, I know there are lots of them. Obviously, spirituality is one. Another one, I think, is the aesthetic sensibility, which I think in many cases is denied us by the modern world. Concentrating on that faculty that we have for aesthetic experience, I think, is really important, because we can then value things that have almost a timeless quality about them and give us a resistance to just the new for its own sake. You know, go back to that example. We can hold that book and relish the fact of its feeling, and it's, you're opening up the pages and they have a certain smell to them.
Yes.
You know, and the aesthetic appeal of walking through your own vegetable patch and actually pulling off the fruit from the plant itself, and the sound of that and the smell of that and the breeze going by you, and you know, cultivating that aesthetic sensibility is quite subversive, I think, in that sense.
Yeah,
and something, you know, the schools don't do much about this, you know. Aesthetics, what's that? Oh, that's something, sort of a rarefied thing that useless philosophers study. But we all experience it, and we should cultivate it.
Yeah.
Because I think it's a route back to our humanity.
I go to a discussion group in the town where I live, and there's a lady who's an artist, in fact, as in a painter. She draws as well. And I asked her what she thought of AI art. And she said, well, some of it's quite clever, but she doesn't. She says, if AI is the art of the future, then I don't want to be part of it. No. You know, as in the only art of the future.
I don't believe it. I think about it's dead art. AI art is dead art. And I think most people will see it as that. And to go back to my point, if we can cultivate the aesthetic, people will see that even more.
Yeah.
Okay, it might function, you know, for advertising or for being at the front of a podcast or something, you know, to accompany a podcast. Yeah. But as being something you would cherish and keep and imagine yourself connected with the soul of the creator of that art. No way. It's just AI. It's nothing. There'll always be a place for that meeting of souls, as it were, meeting of minds imaginatively with the appreciator and the artist. Surely.
Yep.
I reckon.
Let's hope so.
I think so. Yeah.
Let's hope so.
Indeed. Yeah. Well, thanks ever so much, Anthony, for suggesting this. It is one that was on my list, as I say, but perhaps not at the top of the list. So it was great to bring it to the top and enjoyed watching it again. Now, having had this conversation, I want to watch it again. Wonderful film, and was definitely the right way to approach it. And as a consequence, Kubrick created a classic that I think is both enjoyable, but also has so much that's important to remind us of, both in terms of the reality behind the scenes at the time, which people weren't aware of mostly, and the lessons that it can teach us today. So great film. Thanks for the conversation.
Yes, you're welcome. Yeah. And for both our audiences, Film Gold and The Mind Renewed, if you don't know too many of Kubrick's films, there's a very manageable number of films. There's only actually, he made two films at about an hour long each, but From the Killing, which also had Sterling Hayden, which is 1956, I believe, there's only actually 11 films. And in fact, Spartacus, Kubrick was pretty much director for hire. He was brought on halfway through it. So I would argue there's only really 10 full-length, quote-unquote, Kubrick film. So that's a very manageable number. So I would try and investigate all of them if I were you folks. And, for my Film Guide audience, recommend The Mind Renewed, obviously. MindRenewed.com, isn't it?
It is, TheMindRenewed.com,
TheMindRenewed.com, And, I've had a great time.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Anthony. Good to speak to you again. I look forward to the next one, which I don't know what will be. We've got a list of things, haven't we, to talk about. Oh, I know, we're going to talk about... the truth movement and epistemology, the theory of knowledge, should be very interesting.
Yeah, and one of the things that will follow on from this discussion is this idea of things that used to be massively conspiratorial ideas that are now in the mainstream.
Yes.
E.g. Operation Paperclip, Operation Mockingbird, military-industrial complex, government selling arms, etc.
etc.
All these things that have always been out there, but now they're weirdly accepted, you know. Very interesting.
Indeed. Okay, thanks very much. Great to speak to you.
You too. Take care.
Show notes for this program can be found at The Mind Renewed, themindrenewed.com. Podcast music by the brilliant Anthony Rajikov, attribution non-commercial share alike 4.0 international. You have been listening to me, Julian Charles, and my guest, Anthony Rotuno, and I very much look forward to speaking to you again in the near future.
Several experiments, and I have come to this conclusion.
So?
You think that you have lost your love. Well, I saw her yesterday. It is you that she is thinking of, and she's told me what to say. She says she loves you.
Yeah!
Yeah? Yeah! She loves you.
Yeah!
Yeah! Yeah! She loves you.
Yeah! Yeah!
Yeah! Yeah. Yeah. She said, you hurt her so.
Good.
She almost lost her mind. And now she says she knows that you're not the hurting kind.
I am.
She says she loves you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. She loves you.
Yeah.
Yeah.